So it's interesting that you should talk about this as a performance, because that's actually the way that I approach the book. Have you read the introduction, my introduction to the book? Because that's exactly what I say in the introduction to the book, is that I'm a playwright by trade, mainly, an actor and a playwright, a theatre maker, and I really, in order to get through any of the kind of roadblocks that I found, you know, in making this book, and, you know, there are many in making this kind of book, I always had to remind myself that actually I need to remember that I am a writer for performance, and that this is a book that works best in my mind if it is performed live to a live audience at La Mama, having, you know, an audience just come along one night to a really kind of warm, beautiful night, and just have people grabbing you, performers grabbing you and taking you all over the place and just telling you story after story after story, and every story adds a little bit more to your understanding of La Mama. That's the way that I wanted to approach this book. But knowing as well that in doing so, even if you're there for 3 hours and you hear 20, 30 people talk, or there's about 60-odd people who talk in this book, you're only ever getting a fragment of the story, and there's another play that you could come to on another night, and another way of expressing that same story on another night. And that was something that I was aware of the whole time I was telling this story, or helping to shape this story, because actually most of the words of this book are not my words. They're the words of the La Mama community. And that makes this a kind of interesting experience for me, because for most of the process of making this book, I've had to shut up. I've had to ask the questions in a sort of precise way as I can, just to allow the people who I've been speaking to talk. This is an 80,000 word limit book, and in order to allow people to speak as much as possible, it had to be their voice, not mine. And even then, it's so fragmentary, this thing. Anyway, none of that was in my planned talk for tonight. I just wanted to. It's interesting, and I also was like, I've never given a lecture before, so I was thinking, how do I approach this lecture? And really, in preparing for it, I was thinking, well, I'm doing a stand-up comedy routine. That's probably not going to be funny. So like other stand-up comedy routines I have done in my life, I used to be a stand-up comic. It didn't go well. This is an exercise book that on every page I have a little reminder of what I'm going to talk about throughout this, written in big black texter. I have no idea what time it is or how I'm going for time. Well, good, because I hate it when someone's reading from a script and you're counting down the script. But just so you know, if I don't turn a page every 3 minutes or so, 2.5, 3 minutes, I'm behind. So watch that. First of all, I really wanted to say thank you for having me here. It's a really lovely thing to be here, to speak to people who I assume wouldn't be in this room unless you were either interested in La Mama or interested in history making. History makers yourself, you know, the lovers of history. I watched yesterday the introductory video to the RHSV, and it really made me feel very good about speaking here tonight, because there's so many things that are said in that kind of were the same sort of goals I had with this book. Mostly in terms of, this isn't a history of something that happened. It isn't a history of a place that was. It's a living story of an organism that is still finding its feet in the world. And it's just as much about this book, the way I see it. It's just and you say this on your introductory video, it's just as much about finding a map for the future as it is talking about the things that have happened over the last 50 years. And I would love this book to be for other theatre makers. I would love this book to sort of serve as a map for enriching their experience when they come to La Mama, and enriching their approach to making work at La Mama, which has a very particular kind of... it has very particular qualities of the kind of work that thrives there. And I also would love it if it's a sort of map for audience coming to La Mama to gain a kind of new understanding or an enriched understanding of what the place is and what it is for artists to be making work there. And I would also love it to be a map for the administrators of La Mama and the people who are planning for La Mama's future to say, well, in this book, there are some things that we're very proud of and some parts of the story that we love that we have created that story. What are we going to make sure we keep of that? What do we want to build from this map? That's kind of how I want this book to be received. Okay, still not talking about anything that I plan to talk about. So I'm going to assume, even though I know it's not true, that none of you know anything about La Mama. But I think it probably is true that there's at least one person in this room who has never been to La Mama. There we go, good. So I want to talk a little bit about what La Mama is for the uninitiated, but also it will give you an insight into what La Mama is for me, I suppose, and really this book can only exist in ways that comes from what La Mama is to me. La Mama isn't like, it's a theatre, but it's not like other theatres. It's a room smaller than the room we're in right now, and it holds less audience, probably about the same amount of audience who are here in this room right now, on a kind of average night. This is a La Mama audience that we're with right now. There are shows that have had 70 or 80 people in there, but it's a very, very squeezy experience if that's the case. And there are more often shows that have one or two audience members come along. But this is a pretty good La Mama audience, and it doesn't look like a theatre. It looks like a cellar at the bottom of the stairs in a horror movie, it's got all the kind of the ghosts and the voices of the past, the energies that have been there from this last 50 years, and also what the place was before the 50 years. You can feel all of that when you walk into La Mama. And really, if you look at photos in the book of shows that were on 45 years ago, La Mama looks identical to the way it looks now. The only difference is, they've improved the sort of the grounds of La Mama, the forecourt and the courtyard of La Mama is a much nicer place than it was even 10 years ago. But inside the theatre, the only difference is there's more and more layers of paint. If you think of a space... It's a thing that people talk about a lot at La Mama, particularly now. But it's quite an incredible thing if you think that a La Mama show goes for about 2 weeks usually. That's the average amount of time that any show is in that space. And probably every second or third show, often every show, adds their own layer of paint to the wall, which means the paint on the walls is about that thick. I'm not joking. People have excavated the wall. Apparently, a few years ago, a builder came in to work on to screw something into the wall, and they drilled into the wall and they realised that on the other side of the, apart from the paint, the bricks were just dust. So the only thing that's holding up the building these days is the paint. So that gives La Mama, just that in itself gives La Mama a really interesting feel to be part of there. The other thing that gives La Mama an interesting feel is that this isn't a theatre where your audience is way over there and the performers are way over there shouting at you. That's not what La Mama is. La Mama is a space where the performers are right up with you and they're whispering to you and you can hear every word they say. And that's and you can smell them. that's a really... In terms of being a theatre maker, that has a profound impact on the way you approach your work, or the way you should be approaching your work, certainly. In terms of being an audience, it has a profound impact on, I guess, how comfortable an experience it is watching a play. La Mama's a dangerous space. If you fall asleep in La Mama, everyone knows you've fallen asleep. Everyone can hear not just you snoring, but you breathing like you're asleep. And so you become the object of attention in La Mama. It's a thing. And I've been in lots of theatres where people fall asleep. It's a thing that happens. So but also if you're not enjoying yourself, if you're shuffling in your seat, the performers know that. The performers know they're doing a dog of a performance because you're right there shuffling around. It's a very interesting space. It's been more than 3 minutes since I turned a page, so I'm gonna keep moving. Now, in terms of this book, it's probably a little bit. It's quite important to just talk for a little bit about who I am. I'm not a historian. I studied history at La Trobe Uni. I did a honours in history, and probably really quite key to the way I approached this book. My thesis was called The Theatricality of History Making, which was really the idea that you were kind of talking about, that everything is based on a true story and everything is one perspective of whatever that story is. And a very, very important part of making any history is establishing a relationship with the audience that you're telling that history to. If you don't establish that relationship, then the history will disappear. There are obviously big things that happen in the world, but we know more about the things that have happened in the world when a skilled storyteller has told us about them, and when we as an audience are excited to be grabbing onto this history that we've been being told. And so that idea has been with me throughout my studies in history, which, you know, were very short 4 years, but also very much throughout my career as a playwright, and every play that I've written, and very much throughout the writing of this book. It's also important, as you may have guessed by now, that this is a story, this is a book. I'm not the writer of this book, by the way, I'm the curator of this book. In some ways, my authorial voice is throughout this book, and many, many things have come from my idea of what I want this book to be and what La Mama is to me. But, you know, I'm not claiming that I'm the writer of it or anything like that, but I am an insider. This is an insider history. It's not a book that's been put together with the perspective of someone who can stand outside La Mama and see it, the kind of picture that you would see what that place is if you weren't so intimately kind of engaged with all the things that La Mama is. And that is going to skew my perspective very much of how this this story is told. It certainly informed my philosophy for all my kind of rules for myself of whether or not the book was successful, or whether or not the way I was telling the book was working. They're probably really key things to know about both La Mama and myself in terms of what the book is. Whether I was an insider or an outsider, the starting point for telling this story and for putting this book together would almost certainly have been the archives, the La Mama archives, which are wonderful. You lovers of history, if you ever get a chance to pour through the La Mama archives, I recommend it. It's a wonderful thing to do. Every piece of paper that has ever been associated with any La Mama play for 50 years, every single thing from the posters to the flyers to the scripts that never happened, there's actually textbooks exactly like this that are filled with David Williamson's handwriting of plays that were never performed there, that are in the archives. But not only that, every receipt that anyone ever spent on a prop or a costume or a bit of set.
Paint,
absolutely. The big cost, the big budgetary cost of La Mama shows in the first days was posters. posters were the really, really, which you might remember, I don't know, they were the really, really expensive things of Lumumba, but also notes that the staff passed to each other and letters that they received, all the really private things of kind of what comes from running a very intimate kind of place like this. All any article that's written, any review that's read, all of that stuff is in these archives.
Where are the archives?
They're housed at the Melbourne Uni Archives. So in order to access them, you really just have to go through the Lumumba, the Melbourne Uni Library. But they are hypnotising. and they are life-sucking, time-sucking things. There are thousands of boxes, or at least hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of boxes. I don't know exactly how many boxes there are, but for every, let's say even in the early years, there would be, when there were 23 shows a year, there would be 10 boxes per year, 10 boxes, and they were production files and admin files. So even for the early years, there were 10 boxes per year. For the later years, when there's like 75 shows every year, there's like exponentially more boxes than that. And each box, just to take the briefest kind of recon kind of scan through, is about an hour of time. And I realized pretty early on in the making of this book that this wasn't going to be a book made from the archives. The archives were going to feature, they were going to feature in the kind of the textures of the book, but this wasn't going to be an academically put together history of Lumumba, which might disappoint some people. And I would encourage any kind of academically minded historian to go to those archives and make another book, because there is definitely at least one other book, 20 other books in those archives. Malcolm Robertson, who was a sort of, I think he directed the first full season play at Lumumba called Whitson House, Where Are You? And has been an elder of the theatre community in Melbourne for his whole life, who passed away a couple of years ago. He was the first person I interviewed for this book. And he made this comment that for him, as wonderful as the archives are, they're dead. there's a richness missing from them because they can't speak. And I really took that on board, and I'm like, well, why do I need to go to all these boxes when overwhelmingly the people who made these plays and wrote these notes and did all these things, they're still here. And so I very early in the process determined that I was going to speak to every single person who has ever worked at Lumumba. Obviously, I can do that. that's about 7,000 people, I think. And that, you know, it was crazy. And I'm turning the page. I'm not up to that bit yet, what I was just talking about. I want to talk just briefly about, now that I've sort of given a background of my starting point and what Lumumba is and who I am, why I decided to write this book in the first place. Because the why I really explains the kind of book that it is, I think, and that the processes that I'm going to describe from this point on really comes from this why. I actually didn't know when I first approached Liz about this, Liz Jones, who's the artistic director of Lumumba, about this, that Lumumba was very soon going to be turning 50. That wasn't my reason to write this book. I had just been, I just completed in 2014 Masters of Writing for Performance at the Victoria College of the Arts, and I briefly toyed with the idea, even though I'm really bad at academia, I briefly toyed with the idea of doing a PhD, and my idea for that PhD was going to be based around the question, how do you capture in a history the ephemeral, given that, and thinking very specifically about Lumumba and my experience with Lumumba and my experience with theatre making, like theatre making has changed my life and changed the lives of so many people I know in little and big ways. And yet, really, what it is a collection of things that exist for 2 weeks, max, really. The rehearsal process and the making process, sure, but really they exist for 2 weeks. For those 2 weeks, they are the most important thing in the world to the people who are making them. There is nothing else on earth for those 2 weeks apart from those plays. And then they're gone forever. And in the case of La Mama shows, they never happen again. They're forgotten forever. But there's moments within that 2 weeks that every time you do a show, really, but some shows more than others, that you know have transformed you, and you also know that in some way they've transformed at least one person in your audience. And for me, that's a really interesting thing to try and capture in a history. And I think it's a bit of an impossible thing to do. But that was kind of the question that led me into wanting to try and tell this story. It was an attempt at trying to capture the ephemeral, the importance of the ephemeral. Because La Mama is important, not for any big things that it has done. Even though in the early years it was really, really, some of the big things that it did were really important and really formative to the Australian cultural landscape. For me, La Mama's important to the little things that it does over and over and over again every day, every day of its existence. So that was they were my starting points. That question, and also realizing I wanted to make a history from voices, an oral history, to create something that was told from an oral history. There is a story of La Mama that gets told a lot in the media, and anytime it's the sort of the easy story to tell about La Mama, and it doesn't really feature at all in this book, which will surprise a lot of people, I think. And that's La Mama was founded in 1967 by Betty Burstall, who was a woman who went to New York, and while she was over in New York, she fell in love with the off-off Broadway scene over there, the really vivid off-off Broadway scene over there. And really central to that off-off Broadway scene over there was Ellen Stewart's La Mama Theatre, La Mama Inc., I think it was called, which was what was known as a coffee house theatre. You went along, you paid a couple of dollars to see a show, you had a cup of coffee and you watched a show. And Betty fell in love with that idea, came back to Melbourne and looked for something like that existed here, found that there was nothing like that existed here. And so she said, well, with her husband, I'm gonna make a place like that in Melbourne. She bought the building that La Mama is still in from... No, she didn't buy the building. She was renting the building. she found the building that La Mama is still in. The building wasn't actually bought until 2008. And then she went through a process of finding people to make shows there. And some of those people that she found to make shows there are still the iconic names of Australian theatre, like David Williamson and Jack Hibbard and John Romerall, Graham Blundell, lesser kind of known names, but people who have really been the foundation not only of Australian theatre, but also Australian film, and the sort of the whole scene at that time. And really importantly about those early years of La Mama, this was the first time, apart from sort of moments, sort of isolated moments like the summer of the 17th Doll in 1955, this was the first time that the Australian voice came on to the Australian stage. Before that, it was always voices from England, or to a lesser extent, voices from America. And even when it was Australian actors playing out these plays that were written by these voices, and often it was international actors that were coming to Melbourne to perform them, even when it was the Australian actors, they performed them with English accents. So it was the first real opportunity for Australian writers, and many of whom had sort of sprung up after the success of Summer of the 17th Doll, it was the first chance for them to tell their story, to get on stage, to get their voices on stage. It was a really, really, really exciting time. And part of getting that Australian voice on stage was that there was a... suddenly came into the voice, the sort of uncensored voice, or the swear words, for want of better... like, for the first time, rules were being broken, laws were being broken by bringing sort of language onto the stage that had never been used before. And one of the really important things, or big things, that happened in La Mama was a kind of fight against censorship and people getting arrested and all that sort of stuff. That's the stuff that is very, very important about La Mama, but it's a story that's been told a lot. And it's also a story that speaks very loud in the first 10 years of La Mama. But I was confronted after I approached Liz about making this book, and she said, well, actually, I'm looking for a writer to write the 50-year history. I was confronted with the truth that I wasn't just writing about those first 10 years, I was writing about the whole 50 years. And in order to make the other 40 years seem interesting, when they actually don't have the big, really important historical things that have happened in the last 40 years, that they're not as anywhere near as much a part of the La Mama story as they were in that first 10 years. In order for the book to be balanced, I needed to find a different way of telling, a different story to tell. And one of the really formative things too in the way I was approaching this way of different telling the story differently, or telling a different story, was there was a documentary, I think it was on SBS or the ABC, pretty early in the time I was working on this book. I think it was called Raising the Curtain. I don't know if anyone saw that, but it was essentially a history of Australian theatre. And what it made me feel about the industry, that's the wrong word, but the world that I existed in, was that it was a world very much filled with elites that was playing to elites, that was telling, and that it wasn't really communicating anything of any kind of value about what it is to be human. All it was doing was putting on wigs and costumes and being entertaining, which is got... I love that. That's a very valuable thing. But there was, in that whole many episode long Raising the Curtain, they never sort of approached that kind of thing of like getting beyond the wigs and the entertainment. And even Cate Blanchett, who worked at La Mama a couple of times in the 80s or 90s, she spoke. And she's one of the people who often speaks about La Mama in the media. Graham Blundell often speaks about La Mama in the media. David Williamson sometimes speaks about La Mama in the media. And Cate Blanchett, because she's very, very famous and she worked there, speaks about La Mama in the media. And she spoke about La Mama as a place that was, as if it didn't exist anymore. And so, and maybe for her it doesn't. And so that they were all things of trying to find... So, okay, I want to tell a different story. I have to... Actually, it wasn't even a want. It was I have to tell a different story to make these... to find my way into this other 40... this next 40 years beyond the first 10. And so... and I had this idea of talking to every single person that's ever worked at La Mama. At the time, I was also working with a research assistant. Roisin Liner was her name. And she was not a La Mama insider. She was a student at La Trobe Uni who just approached Caitlin over here, I think, because she wanted to get involved in a kind of research exercise. And so she was poring through the archives with me. But not only were we going through the archives together, we were talking about what kind of book this should be. And I was talking all about, I want to talk to this person and just see what they say. That's all I wanted to do. I wanted to talk to everyone and just see what they say. I didn't want to go in with an agenda. I just wanted to find out what people told me about La Mama. Whereas she had these really key questions about what's the story of women at La Mama? What's the story of the Indigenous voice at La Mama? What's the story of the other voice at La Mama? What's the story about censorship? What's the story about La Mama's place in the cultural landscape, but also the larger, broader landscape of Australia? What's the story in local history and all those sort of things? And she was really, the things that she said to me, really, they didn't necessarily change my idea of talking to as many people as I could, but they helped, when I was talking to those people, me form ways of talking to them. Because I definitely didn't want to predict what anyone would say. I didn't want to have my own agenda, explicitly so anyway. I still wanted just to see what came. But her questions really, I knew they were important questions to approach in the book. And they're not often questions that are talked about in that sort of the basic history of La Mama that's always told. And they are in this book. So that's one thing that I can definitely say in this book in terms of things that how this book works as a history of the place. It's a history of those kind of the changes in those kind of key ideas around when the other kind of voices came into the Australian landscape, as well as the not other voices as well. How are we going for time? Tell me though, because because there's a step I could skip. all right, okay. What? 25 past? Okay. Wow. Whew. All right. We will get to a point where I'm just going to stop and just you can ask questions, which might end up answering some of the things that I would say anyway. I do want to say this part of it, just because it's sort of in terms of thinking about what La Mama is, I always tend to go to analogies. I find it very easy, much easier to tell stories when I'm talking about things as something else. And for me, the way I look at La Mama, there's two analogies that sort of I keep on coming back to. One is an analogy about what La Mama is, and one is an analogy about the kind of book that I think this is. The first analogy is the Big Bang. I think when Betty Burstall came back from New York and founded La Mama and brought those voices into the space, it was like a Big Bang that sparked a whole new universe in Australia. The whole cultural landscape of La Mama that exists as it exists today would not have existed if Betty Burstall hadn't have done that. There still would have been a cultural landscape, but it would be a very different kind of universe. Everything from not just the little theatres and the filmmaking, but everything that's on the main stages as well in Australia, and all the performers and everything, they owe something to that moment that Betty Burstall came back. And so there was this Big Bang in 1967, which burnt very brightly and very hot for those first few years, and then it expanded. And the universe that it formed is still expanding. And not only is it still expanding, new planets, new performers, new writers, new voices, new whatever are still sparking into existence because of that Big Bang. Voices like mine that would never have existed without that Big Bang. So that's sort of one analogy. Is when I think about, when I'm talking about La Mama, I'm actually talking about this expanding universe, this expanding cultural universe that was sparked when Betty Burstall came back from New York. A really significant thing, I think, in that she did in sparking that. The other analogy in terms of this book is, I think, about a battlefield. And in terms of history that I'm interested in, I'm not interested in military history, really, in terms of talking about war, but I am interested in terms of talking about the soldiers or in terms of talking about the people who were impacted by the war. And really, when I had this idea to speak to every single person who's ever worked at La Mama, I was imagining that this was a battlefield with 7,000 soldiers and every single... And fighting some kind of other enemy that's not human or something. Fighting some kind of metaphorical enemy, let's say. But every one of those soldiers had their own little battle within there, had their own little heroic moments, had their own glorious things that happened and their own deaths and their own times when they came to a comrade's aid or their own time when someone came to their aid and gave them new life and new hope. What I was trying to collect wasn't a picture of a war from the outside, like the big battle from the outside, but a patchwork of all those little one-on-one battles of each soldier. And going along with that battlefield kind of analogy, it is a battle that has its generals, it's the people who've put them there, like Betty Burstall, the great heroes like David Williamson and others, but it also has its cannon fodder. And because I'm one of the cannon fodder, because I'm one of the people who's not one of the great heroes of this battle, but someone who's just sort of working away, just stabbing my bayonet or whatever I'm doing, I guess I'm much more attracted to the story of other cannon fodder. And so this is a book filled with cannon fodder. And actually, in terms of the process of working out who I was going to speak to for this book, very early in the process, and it was a very flawed process. I'm going to say that right now. And one of the things that I talk about early in the book is there are so many things missing. There are so many factual errors. There are skewed perspectives. There's all sorts of things in this book. But one of the things that I did early on in the process was put a call out to anyone who's worked at La Mama to approach me with their stories. And that produced some interesting results, because a lot of people that were approaching me were people who were like, well, you probably wouldn't actually get a chapter in the La Mama book or whatever, but I'm going to talk to you anyway. And often talking to them, I was like, wow, what a great story you've told me. I'm definitely going to put that in. And if I was hearing about the generals or the heroes who were waiting for me to call them, or who were angry with me for not calling them yet, I didn't call them. because I was like, this is a story where you come to La Mama. I'm actually explaining this to say one of the flawed things that was in the process of writing the book. Like David Williamson, for example, I made a meeting with his agent to have a phone interview with him, and he didn't pick up the phone. So David Williamson doesn't have a chapter. So there are, and by the way, I hold nothing against David Williamson at all. I think he's great. I'm just saying that sort of explains some of the weird process of putting this book together. I don't actually think it's a lesser book for that, because I think all the stories in here are beautiful. But they're not the stories necessarily that people would expect them to be, which I live in fear of going outside at the moment for the berating that I'm getting from people. As I got when I arrived here tonight, when I left one play off the chronology, one, and it was yours. it's terrible. I'm spent this whole however long I've been speaking just thinking, oh my, how did I miss that? Well, I hope you are, but I don't think I don't. Yeah. Anyway, another thing that I didn't go into in terms of what this book is, that I didn't intend the book to be necessarily when I said I wanted to speak to 7,000 people. I had one of the people I spoke to was a playwright named Cynthia Troop, who I'd never met before, who I'd heard great things about, but I heard she wanted to talk to me, so I talked to her, and until I spoke to her, I probably intended that from the interviews that I had with people, I was just going to bring fragments of those interviews to the book. It was going to be a collection of fragments woven together by with a kind of narrative that I was going to tell. But when I spoke to Cynthia, I spoke to her for just over an hour, I think, and I barely said anything. It was like the most beautiful monologue that had been considered for weeks before she'd spoken to me, even though I know it wasn't, because we arranged the meeting really quickly, where there wasn't a word out of place. And I recorded these conversations with my phone, and I if I had not included every word she spoke, or at least for a big chunk of what she said, it would have been lesser. The story would have been lesser, because there was something about the way she wove her tapestry that was just, it was just gorgeous. And it also, not only did it say something very profound about her experience of La Mama, it said something about the approach to being a theatre maker that was so totally alien to me, very different to the way I approach my theatre, much more considered and much more intricate and much more precise and perfect. And much, I think, much more beautiful. I fell in love with her words. And from speaking to her from that point onwards, I thought this is going to be a book of fairly long form conversations. So really, what you'd find in this book is mostly, not all of it, but 1,000 to 2,000 to 3,000 words of just someone talking. And through that 1,000 to 3,000 words of people talking, when they're added all together, you get some kind of three- or four-dimensional picture of what La Mama is. And and there are some submissions in the book from people that I didn't interview, but they just sent me kind of their own sort of things about La Mama. But that's really what this book is, woven together that way, but also with some beautiful pictures, photographs, to bring it out. And I think there's a beauty to just that, just sitting with someone for their 1,000 words and just hearing that little fragment of their own story. How's time? Okay, all right. I really apologise that I'm nowhere near finished, but what I'll do, I'll just say this last one, because it's sort of, if you ever end up reading this book, I think this is an interesting thing to know what my starting questions were. When I sat down with someone to interview them, I really asked two questions. And I found that I didn't need to do anything other than that. That asking these two questions allowed people to speak for an hour and opened them up in ways that were like, well, that's the whole story. It's not the whole story, it's the beginning of a story. But that's what I wanted anyway. I wanted a beginning of a story because I didn't want to finish this La Mama story. And the two questions really were, how did you first become aware of the existence of La Mama? There might be someone in this room who first became aware of the existence of La Mama when they saw the ad for this event, for example. And has your perception, or how has your perception of La Mama changed since then? Since you first heard about its existence, how has it changed? What does La Mama mean to you now? And so if you are that person who first heard about La Mama when you saw this event advertised, you'll now be thinking, your understanding of La Mama will be different to what it was when you read that ad, maybe, who knows. Just asking those two questions, especially the one about how your perception of La Mama has changed, I think opened people up, because really when it comes down to it, in terms of trying to capture a history of the ephemeral, what this is, and I actually saw this written in an ad for the book and I don't remember writing it, so I think someone got it right, is a history of what Lumumba feels like. It's not a history of necessarily of all the things that happened there. It's a history of what it feels like to walk into the place, to work there, to see a show there, to have Lumumba exist in our cultural landscape, what that feels like. And that's, I think, key to this book. I've lots more I was going to say, but
so
what? Yeah, sure.
Conversation around that, because I've had to ask you the question. The first time you had a show, something you wrote for Lumumba, the first time you were there, what effect did that have on your life?
Well, the first time I was there as a Lumumba show, I was actually there as a performer, mm-hmm. which was really. I'll talk about the writing experience though. First time I wrote a play for Lumumba, I was actually in the play that had been rehearsed for weeks as a performer, and then it was written by three writers. I wasn't one of the writers, I was just a performer. Then those three writers had a falling out. One of them withdrew their work and said, "You can't use it anymore." And in solidarity, the other two writers said, "All right, well, we won't, none of us will use our work." And then they all approached me and said, "Can you write us a play in a week?" But because they got put, it was part of the Next Wave Festival, and because they'd become part of this festival with their names attached to it, their names remained attached to it. I wrote every word of the play, but I wasn't credited for it. But I kind of loved that. The play got great reviews. Like, it got great reviews, and I loved reading these things. I loved that. But it also, my performance is what Liz Jones, the artistic director of Lumumba, and Lloyd Jones, her husband, they came and saw the play, and after they saw my performance in the play, I was handed a card at the end of the night with Call Me, and I became part of the Lloyd Jones ensemble, which I performed in like 20 or 30 shows with that ensemble. And it changed my life. So that was my first experience.